Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Tomorrow is International Champagne Day, and it couldn't be a more timely moment to consider the name Champagne and the weight that it carries in identifying sparkling wine, luxury, and marketing. Just this morning, news came out about a class action lawsuit that was filed against an airline by a flyer who says during the, quote, champagne service, he was served sparkling wine. It may sound frivolous to some, but 1,200 flyers have signed on to that class action lawsuit. It's an interesting turn in the long and storied history of the champagne name, which is now almost synonymous with luxury. Still, it's a protected area of origin, meaning sparklers from other parts of the world don't get to call themselves champagne. It also means that wines from that northern region of France have certain rules to live up to. Here to walk us through what makes champagne so particular is Master Sommelier Andrew McNamara. He's the Vice President of Wine Development for Florida distributor Breakthrough Beverage. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We are talking about champagne. You can become part of this conversation, too, by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag GCL. Andrew, before we get into champagne, you just got back from a trip to St. Louis, where you, as the chairman of the board of the Court of Master Sommeliers, presided over the graduation, I guess it's called, of eight new Master Sommeliers. Were you surprised to have eight people pass that really difficult test?
We weren't surprised to have eight people pass the test. We in any given year, we never really know how many it's going to be. Some years, there's been as few as one. In other years, we've seen 15 to 16. This was an overall really well-prepared, masterly group. So I think eight was not out of the question in the least. And I saw a great number of performances from individuals that next year I would expect to see a large number as well.
How many people took the test this time around?
There were 58.
58 of them. And I saw the speech that you gave to them all in that announcement, and it was very inspiring. And also, any discussion about anything concerning wine this week is going to have to include some conversation about the wildfires in California wine country that have raged through neighborhoods there. Have you been watching this from afar in horror?
Absolutely, and been in contact with our producers and friends, and I have so many friends that live out there. Just getting daily updates as to what's going on, and it's just really tragic.
Has there been any estimation so far about how much of a loss this is going to be to the industry, or are they still just trying to get back up on their feet?
I think everybody's still just trying to get back up on their feet at this point. It's a little bit too soon. There's still fires that are going on. There seem to be a lot of damage to residential areas. Vineyards, most of the vineyards out there are irrigated, and so they do tend to have some natural buffer against fires in vineyards, and they do offer somewhat of a fire break. But in all honesty, there's a lot of grasses that grow between the vineyards, and those are very dry this time of year, and I've heard reports of many of that part of the vineyard has caught on fire, leading to some issues. But there's kind of a mix of people that have already harvested and those that still have grapes on the vines, and that'll be very interesting to see the difference between those two.
It'll be interesting to see what kind of impact that smoke exposure is going to have on the grapes.
Absolutely.
So let's turn now to Champagne. You've been to the region a number of times. What makes that part of France so special?
It's really just one of the most beautiful spots in all of France. It's this generally hilly area about 45 minutes by train to the northeast of Paris. So first, it's one of the most northerly growing regions in the world. There are certainly some that are a little further north where you get into England and the like, but for French wine, it far and away is the most northerly. So you're dealing with a wide variety or a wide range of climates in a given year and a wide range of temperatures. And it's an area where it's very highly impacted by the weather. You are fairly close to the North Sea, the Atlantic Ocean, all have impacts in that area. So you do get a lot of rainy days and very cool days in the summertime during the growing season. And so the grapes do struggle to get really ripe up there. It creates an environment where you have everything that you could want to make a perfect sparkling wine. Which is you want freshness and brightness in the wine, and I'll use a couple technical terms, but you really want a lot of acidity in the wine. That's what really carries that brightness and that freshness into the bottle, is just having that extra dose of acidity along with some really pretty, elegant ripe grapes. It's a fairly large region, but just in terms of overall size, but the areas that are actually planted to grapes is relatively small and generally comprises these beautiful hillsides in the area.
I wanted you to break it down for me, though. Champagne is the name of a region, correct? It's not the
correct name
of the wine.
Correct. Champagne is a region. It is not a style of wine. It is a place. They make sparkling wine in Champagne. They also make still wine in Champagne. We've kind of adapted that to mean all sparkling wines. But the French are, as they should be, are very protective of that name.
So what makes Champagne different from other kinds of sparkling wines? I mean, other than its provenance, that it's from the Champagne region of France. But are there rules that they have to follow in Champagne that makes it different or more difficult to create?
Absolutely. It's the wine laws in Champagne are some of the most strict of any wine region in the world, not just in France, but in the entire world. They really make sure that your yields aren't particularly high. They only allow, we'll mostly talk about three grape varietals, but there really are seven that are permitted to be used and are planted. So you've got these small number of grapes. You've got this very delimited area from which you can grow these grapes from. That's really it. It's you can see sparkling wines made of very, very high quality in other places like Italy and in California and South America and South Africa and Australia. So there is some really great sparkling wine made in other spots, but here it is that. But it more than anything is something called the méthode champenoise, or the méthode traditionnelle, as you'll see in other parts of France, and we might know it as the Champagne method. Which means that you harvest the grapes and you make a wine just like you would any other wine. But then you take the wine, you put it in a bottle with a little bit of yeast and sugar and some nutrients, and you leave it there for quite a period of time. And the yeast eats the sugar, converts it into carbon dioxide and alcohol and a little bit of heat. And basically what happens is the carbon dioxide has nowhere to go. I have a firm belief about wine that in order to really understand it, you probably don't need to. You pretty much learned everything you needed to know about it before the eighth grade. And we know that if gas doesn't have anywhere to go, it becomes dissolved in the liquid. And so these bottles, after the yeast and sugar and such are in there, there's a crown cap that's put on it, like a beer bottle top, if you will. And the gas just dissolves itself into the liquid. And so you end up with this process of having bubbles in a bottle, but you've still got all of this yeast and nutrients, and eventually the yeast will die. But that's actually part of the key to Champagne and the flavor of Champagne, is as that yeast dies, it gradually breaks down, those cell walls break down, and they impart this really pretty bread dough brioche type of aroma and flavor into the finished wine. And so that's definitely a key part of it. Non-vintage champagnes are required to be aged at least 15 months. Vintage champagnes are required to be aged at least 3 years. But many of them are doing quite a bit longer than that. And it's not uncommon in some of the really great champagne houses to see wines from vintage years that have been in that process for 10 to 12 years.
What does vintage mean, though, when you're referring to champagne? Because some people with wine may think that everything comes from the given vintage when the grapes were harvested, but is champagne generally not that way?
Correct. Champagne is generally what is known as non-vintage, meaning that they use grapes from many different years. Many houses will use three different vintages. Some houses use as many as 30 different vintages. And really the idea is you're taking different wines to try to come up with a very consistent champagne at the end of the day, meaning that the champagne you make from grapes that were harvested, say, this year, or dominantly harvested from this year, you want that to taste the same as it did last year and the year before and the year before that. And you do that by taking these base wines, these wines from other years, and blending them all together. It is one of the most rigorous and complicated processes in the world of wine, because it's like asking, for those of you that are listening that are cooks, it's like creating your favorite recipe and then tomorrow night being asked to create the exact same dish but with different ingredients. And it's a really interesting part of it. And so when you go out and you buy non-vintage champagne, it should taste the same no matter when the grapes were harvested in, even though there are huge vintage qualities from year to year.
I was going to ask then, why would a winemaker in Champagne make a vintage Champagne? What would drive them to do that?
So the great thing about vintage Champagnes are vintage Champagnes must all come from a given year, and some years are better than others. And there are many houses that like to showcase those really great and unique vintages, those really great and unique growing seasons, by declaring a vintage Champagne. So you do see a good bit of vintage Champagne out there. It's not; they're generally not made every single year. Maybe 5 out of 10. Sometimes you'll see as many as 8 out of 10. Sometimes you'll see as few as 2 out of 10. So it really does depend on the growing conditions as to whether they're going to be the vintage declared.
Calling and it's a declaration of a vintage.
Yep.
It's a big deal. It's a big industry, obviously. But I wanted to ask a little bit more about the difference between Champagne and other sparkling wines. If you get a sparkling wine from another part of France, what is that called?
It is called Cremant. And it's funny, there's actually a little village in Champagne called Cremant, just little variations there, but it's C-R-E-M-A-N-T, and that just refers to sparkling wine from another region. So you see Cremant de Bourgogne, which is sparkling wine from Burgundy, or Cremant de Loire, which is sparkling wine from the Loire Valley. So we do see a number of other sparkling wines that are produced throughout France, and in all honesty, most wine regions around the world do produce sparkling wine of some sort or another.
And so are those made in the same way with the méthode champenoise, with the secondary fermentation there in the bottle, or are any of those made in a different way?
So many of them are made in a different way. There is a process that is used called the Charmat method, which is you basically make your wine and you add yeast and you add your sugar, and it's in a very large tank. Instead of being in the bottle like it is with champagne, it's in a large tank, and that process occurs, and the wines are filtered, and they can be bottled to order at that point. So the wine in that instance, instead of sitting on those yeast cells and having that break down and creating that yeasty, brioche type of flavor and aroma, the wines can come off very, very fresh and bright. So things like Prosecco or Moscato d'Asti use that process where the wines are very bright and clean and fresh and fruity, and they're absolutely fantastic. There's another method that is kind of a hybrid of the méthode champenoise, which is where you do the second fermentation that creates the bubbles in the bottle, but then you empty it into a large tank and then filter it, and then you bottle it into either very, very small bottles or oftentimes very large bottles. Things like Jeroboams and the like, and larger than that, 3 liters of champagne, which is a great thing.
that would be glorious,
made,
yes.
Those are often made in that way because it allows you to have a bottle with significant pressure in it that otherwise, if it went through the traditional way, might explode.
Let's talk about that pressure. How much pressure is in a champagne bottle? I mean, is there a risk of somebody being injured by a flying champagne cork?
Oh, absolutely. So I like to quote a few things whenever I teach about champagne. And it's, you look at the average car tire is about 33-35 pounds per square inch. In a bottle of champagne, you're looking at close to 90. You're looking at, we'll call it atmospheres of pressure. You're looking at almost 6 atmospheres of pressure, which is about 6 times what the general air pressure is outside. So it can be very, very, I don't want to say destructive, but it's definitely something that you need to use caution with. And that's a really key part in opening champagne. There was a news feed I read at one point that said the world record for a cork flying out of a bottle of champagne was 176 feet.
Wow.
Which is pretty remarkable, yeah.
Did they NASCAR it, though, and shake it up first?
I'm sure they did. I'm sure it was very warm, and they shook it up, and that's what happened.
Is warmer worse as far as that pressure issue?
Absolutely. This goes back to the physical science that we might have learned in the 7th or 8th grade, where the warmer the liquid is, the more active the molecules are. And when you go to open that bottle, when you go to open the cork, or you take the cork out, the liquid inside, if it's very warm, those molecules are going to come out of the wine very quickly, and you're going to end up with a lot of carbon dioxide coming out really quickly. And so you can end up losing most of the bubbles, which is what makes champagne champagne.
Is there any way to preserve the bubbles once you've popped that cork?
That's a very interesting question. I've never really found anything that does it long term. There are champagne stoppers that you can use that are specially designed to keep a seal and to keep the pressure in. And that might last for a day or two, but anything more than that really doesn't work. But I rarely have the issue where a bottle of champagne doesn't go unconsumed.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard to not consume the whole thing, and especially because champagne invites friends, does it not?
It absolutely does.
I brought a bottle into the studio with me today, and I wanted to ask you to walk me through the proper technique for how to open the bottle. And I'm looking at it, and it has a foil. Do I have to remove that foil first?
Yeah, so the steps are this. Is number one, it should be very cold, ideally below 40 degrees or so. If it's a little warmer than that, that's okay, but it should be right out of the refrigerator. What you want to do is you do want to take a corkscrew, you want to use a waiter's corkscrew, which is, it has a thread on it, but it also has a knife on it. And you want to use that knife, and you want to cut. You might see that there's a serrated area on the foil, and there might be a little bit of a tab on which to pull that. The best way to do it is to really cut below that and take the foil off that way, and that will gives you a nice, real clean cut. And a lot of times the tabs break, and so you end up having to cut it anyway.
Well, I didn't bring my corkscrew with me because I assumed I didn't need it, so I took advantage of the perforation. So now I'm looking at the cork in the bottle, and I have this wire cage over it. So, and I'm keeping my thumb on top of it because I don't really have it at an ideal cool temperature. But I'm keeping my thumb on there just in case because I don't want to ruin any equipment in the studio. So what do you do first with this foil?
So the first thing you do, want to keep your thumb on top of the cage. You might see sometimes in restaurants where the waiters or whoever is servicing a bottle of champagne takes the cage off. The cage is called a miselu, and it is really there to protect that cork from flying off. What you want to do is you want to keep your thumb on the very top of the cork and wrap your hand around the neck.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you're holding the bottle basically in your hand with your thumb on top, and what you want to do at that point is you want to press down with your thumb. You want to take the cage. You notice there's a little ring on the cage. You want to pull that down and start twisting it so that it opens up 6.5 times. And at that point, it will be relatively loose. But you're going to need to loosen the cage up just a little bit more. Again, your thumb is still on top of the cork at this point.
Uh-huh.
It's really on top of the miso. Then what I do is I tend to move my hand up just a little bit on the bottle. I take my index finger and I physically wrap it around the cork with my thumb still on top of it. And the other three fingers of my hand are still really holding the neck.
Okay. I'm there.
At that point, I want to... Yep. Okay. At that point, you want to grab the bottle. I mean, I don't know if you have it in both hands or one hand,
both.
But you want to grab the bottle. Okay. And at this point, you want it to be at a 45 degree angle. That will allow not as much pressure to build up in the bottle. Allows just a little bit more control over opening it. And
okay.
At this point, what I do is I tend to twist the cork a little bit towards me and the bottle a little bit away from me.
Oh, it's wanting to fly.
Oh, So very slowly, very, very, very slowly. And after it's, after the cork's out about a centimeter, at that point I stop twisting the bottle. There you go.
Yeah. Here.
At that point, I tend to start rocking the cork back and forth just a little bit until I start to hear a little bit of a hiss. And ideally, that's what you're going to hear is just a little. And that's really the best way for the champagne to really meet its end, if you will.
And in propriety, it should not pop. It's supposed to, and I heard somebody describe it as just a little kiss.
Yes, just a little whisper.
Little whisper.
And the reason for that is the popping is really the carbon dioxide expanding really rapidly. That's not what makes the sound. It obviously is the cork coming out of the bottle. But if it comes out and creates a loud pop, you're releasing a lot of carbon dioxide all at once, whereas with the hiss, you release just a little bit less. And when you're going to be enjoying your champagne, when you pour it in the glass, you're going to have lost some of the bubbles if it pops.
So, and the point is,
fun.
Yeah, the point is to keep those bubbles. That's what makes it so special. And so then another question I wanted to ask is the evolution of the glassware that you use with champagne. We had the coupe, then we had the flute, and now I see people using regular white wine glasses. What is the best type of glassware you should use?
It's really a personal preference. I tend to use a variety of glassware depending on the type and style of champagne. For more elegant, more delicate champagnes, I tend to use a flute. I really like the beauty of it. I tend to like flutes that are shaped a little bit more like wine glasses, meaning that they're tapered at the bottom and then tapered at the top as well to create a bowl, because that does capture some of the aromas and you want to do that. There are coupes out there. There are other different types of champagne flutes out there. That's just my preference for lighter, more elegant styles. For slightly richer and heavier styles of champagne, I will generally use a white wine glass. And for me, it's just because I want those aromas and I want that weightiness to really shine in the glass. It's a big myth that champagne doesn't need to open up. It's just like every other wine. It's going to interact with oxygen, and it's going to change over a period of time, either good or bad. But you want it to have that. Mm-hmm. You want it to be able to do that.
So the champagne that I have here is a rosé. Can you explain to people the difference between a rosé champagne and the champagne they may be used to?
Sure, absolutely. So there are, we'll call it Brut Champagne and Rosé Champagne. And you can have Brut Rosé Champagne. Brut refers to dry champagne, meaning not sweet. Rosé is just a coloration. And so there are two ways of making Rosé Champagne. There are two grapes that are red that are dominantly used in the production of champagne. One is Pinot Noir and one is Meunier. If you've ever been to the grocery store or if you've ever taken the skin off of a red grape, you notice that on the inside of it, the flesh is white. It's clear. It's exactly the same with wine grapes, exactly the same with most wine grapes. There are a few that do have red flesh on the inside. But really, all of the color for when Pinot Noir is made into red wine comes from the skins. Same thing with Cabernet Sauvignon and all of your main red grape varieties. So you have these two red grape varieties, Pinot Noir and Meunier. And what happens is you can squeeze the grapes and get the juice to come out and not let it sit on the skin. So what's going to happen is that juice is going to bring in those compounds of color out of the grape skins if you leave it on the skins. If you just take it right off the skins and you don't let it sit there, it doesn't have the chance to absorb that color into the juice, and therefore you're going to end up with a much, much, much lighter style of champagne, or a much lighter color, which in this case would be rosé. And so that's one way, and that method is called Sagny. The other method is simply by making a white wine from either Pinot Noir, Meunier, and or Chardonnay, which is the dominant white grape variety in champagne. You can make white wine out of all three of those grapes, and then at the very end, you add just a little bit, maybe 2 or 3% of red wine, still red wine, and that will cause it to get that color as well. There are the two ways to do it. Yeah, rosé champagne tends to be a good bit more powerful and robust than what you call it regular Brut champagne.
Well, that cork was definitely powerful trying to come out of the bottle. I want to thank you so much, Andrew McNamara, Master Sommelier and Vice President of Wine Development for Breakthrough Beverage. It's been great talking with you today about one of my favorite subjects. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And I look forward to talking with you again soon. Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone, John Davis, and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.